Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, welcome to Brain Injury Radio Network. Tonight is our regular Wednesday installment of our program Recovery Now with your host, Kim Justice. If you'd like to know more about my story, you can find it at inaflash.org. I, too, am a fellow traumatic brain injury survivor. I appreciate you tuning in tonight, and as always, I look forward to your input. So now, we'll get on with the show. Well, hello, and hello again. I'm not sure what happened. The lines all dropped off the board. We're having some storms passing in and out of my neck of the woods tonight, but I don't think that's it because right now we're in between them, so there isn't any lightning and thunder going on like there was. But in any case, welcome to the show tonight. I hope you guys are all having a good week. For those of you who are new around here, Recovery Now is a gathering place for anyone seeking recovery from the challenges of life on life's terms. Guests share their experience, strength, and hope. We discuss useful tools that have helped us lighten the load of our journey through recovery. More will be revealed. This is a we recovery program because it is in the we that we find the new me. We focus on the four A's of recovery: awareness, acceptance, action, and adaptation. This is a place for survivors striving to become thrivers. And for that, it takes a good bit of warrior. Again, I'm your host, Kim Justice. I am here every Wednesday night. If you want to know more about me, pardon me, you can check out my website, inaflash.org. How quickly our lives can change, right? Inaflash.org. If you hear birds singing, I'm on my sun porch right now, which is actually a cloud-pending rain porch, so I'll be popping back and forth between here, hearing the birds singing, if you guys are picking that up, and going into the kitchen. But I'm excited tonight. Actually, he got in touch with me, but it gave me an idea. Frank and I have kept in touch the past years since he was a host here. There's some other hosts that I haven't talked to in many years. And so Frank actually gave me the idea of where they are now, former hosts, and where they are now. We're going to start it aptly with Frank since he gave me the idea. Many of you remember former BIRN host, fantastic Frank Johnson. He was trapped in a fire, carried out in a body bag, and suffered a substantial anoxic brain injury. Motivated to inspire millions, Frank has been a platform speaker, had his story printed in multiple publications, and was, of course, a radio host, among many other things. He has been involved in several enterprises, and one is free to you. Get his free guide, 7 Motivational Secrets to Excel Every Day, at ffhero.com. Of course, that stands for Fantastic Frank, but you don't have to spell it out, ffhero.com. Also, check out his story in the Chicken Soup for the Soul, TBI Soul Edition. soup. Sorry. Okay, I blundered that one. So we know there's a million chicken soups for the soul. There is a TBI soup edition, and Frank's story is in there. There you go. Now, we're going to have someone else join us tonight. Dave Pronko, and he can catch me if I didn't pronounce that correctly. I don't think we ever covered it. But he once served as a paid caregiver for Frank. Most times when we discuss caregiver situations, it seems it's in terms of a spouse or an institutional setting. A private caregiver is another option that we don't often discuss. Yet here the whole time I've known Frank, and when he was a host, he always had one. But that particular subject, at least on my show, I don't think has ever come up. So tonight we're going to hear the pros and cons from both sides of that coin. And then in addition, unfortunately, Dave went on to suffer a couple of horrible accidents and became a survivor himself. In this case, we hear the unique perspective of when the caregiver becomes the survivor. So all kinds of good stuff tonight. Very happy to have Frank back on the show and welcome Dave to be with us as well. And I'm going to bring them on the air right now. Gentlemen, welcome to the show. I'm so glad you could be here tonight.
Hi, Tim. How are you doing? Dave is right here with me, too. And we are talking together.
Hi, Tim. Thanks for having me on the show.
Great to have you. Great to have you both. I know a lot of people remember Frank. We were one of the original seven. For those of you, just a quick brief. Brain Injury Radio has been on about 15 years. The first couple of years, it was only on Monday nights, and our founder, Craig, did the show on Monday nights, and he had such a tremendous response, and I think, I can't swear to this because I wasn't around in the first couple of years. I hadn't heard of the show and was on the other side of the country, but Craig was not as far out from his injury, and he's younger than, I don't know about Dave, but certainly younger than Frank and I. And so he was a little more tech savvy or into, you know, the computer. He started Brain Injury Radio, and I think he was using it as rather a cathartic way to talk through what he was going through, all the shifts in his life from his injury. And so many people could relate. This show streams to all 50 states, 49 countries. It's live to archive, and people were listening and relating to what he was saying, thinking that they had been the only one. And I remember the first time I heard his show, one of the first things he said when I tuned in was something about living in a world of post-it notes. And I was alone, but I suddenly felt like the kid who got caught with her hand in the cookie jar. I didn't think anyone could possibly know. I had post-it notes all over everywhere to try to remember things. And my challenge became trying to remember where the post-it notes were. And so, knowing there was a great need out there that people with brain injury and certain disabilities felt very isolated, and the traditional medical model wasn't always well-versed in our situations. Other people really didn't know much about, you know, they all heard of cancer, heart disease, diabetes, but not so much about brain injury and knowing about it. And so he decided to start running the show seven nights a week. That was about 13 years ago, because that's how long I've been here. And in the beginning, there were seven hosts, one for each night of the week. And Frank was one of the original hosts, I believe, that he came on at about the same time I did, or as Craig was adding the original seven. And so was around for very many years and then had some other pursuits as other hosts that I'll talk to in future weeks and months as I find them again. But in any case, Frank, tonight we were going to talk a little bit, and Dave, we will get to your shift in your life after we start with, as we discussed, the caregiver perspective. And
yeah.
Frank, no, I didn't get any questions from you. My thing doesn't come straight to my phone, so the last message I have is when I told you I sent it out. So I'm just going to kind of wing it, and if there's some way you want to incorporate your question into an answer, you can certainly do that. It just hasn't been. I know, you know, it's funny for those listening, of the seven hosts, well, and now there's 20 hosts. As natural attrition happened, there were some people who would make great hosts, but they weren't able to be a weekly host. And so some of our hosts do a once-a-month show. Some do a twice-a-month show. Two of us, me, who was an original, but then a newer, but he's been with us 5 years. Well, I guess in another, Joey on Saturdays. We have three weekly hosts, and the rest are all split up. Like Thursdays, they're all once-a-month hosts. And one thing I'll say is if you listen to a brain injury radio show and you don't think it's for you or you don't like it, I would encourage you not only to give that host another chance, because we all have our on and off nights and our various things, but there's so many other hosts as well, and we all do things a little bit differently. Some hosts come on with a topic, and they talk about the topic for the length of the show and maybe take some callers. I did that in the beginning. I've been here long enough. I've tried a lot of different things to mix it up. Others write down, have guests and write down questions, and that's what Frank used to do. And I'm more conversational. I have a linear interview that's easy for people to follow because I start at the beginning and we just have a conversation, a little bit of background, which I'm kind of telling you about Frank now, and most of you have heard his story. But basically what happened, what was it like, and what is it like now? And I don't come right out and ask those or put it in the form of questions, but that's kind of the track that my discussion follows. You know, what were you doing in your life? How was, you know, what was going on in your life up to and including the game-changing event that made your life shift? And then what was it like is a process question. And that's where the guests talk about things that particularly impacted them, what they think is important, particularly as a takeaway for the people listening. And then what is it like now is literally how are you now and what are you doing in your life now? Because one thing I think a lot of our guests have in common, not that you can't call here when you're struggling because we are a support network, but a lot of the guests here have gone under the auspices of never give up. And because our life was spared and most of us, including Frank, were on the brink of death, some of us died, you know, for a little bit and came back, but very close to death, and our life was spared. Now, some people can be resentful and stay angry about the fact they can't go back to the plans they had before, the life they had before, the dreams that they envisioned. but I will say, while I empathize and I understand, because I'm a survivor too, if you do that for whatever time you have left, you know, to draw a breath on Earth, I can hear you guys talking. If you're going to talk to each other, mute your mic. Anyway, I'm coming up on you. Anyway, it helps to get off the bench and try so that you don't get stuck in a rut for the rest of the life that you have that's been spared. I'm one who believes that God means us to be happy, joyous, and free in our life, and there's going to be some things, those life on life's terms I was talking about, that we aren't going to like at all. There's going to be a period of grief, a period of adjustment, and it ain't always going to be a bed of roses, but it beats the hell out of giving up. And most of us have found once we try some things, whether we're good at them or not, we're empowered by the fact that we tried. And in that trying, we find some things we don't really care for that. And we find some things eventually that help us redefine our purpose. And that is where we open the second chapter of our life's book and move on from there. So, Frank, let's start with you. You weren't married, so you didn't have a caregiver after the horrible fire and everything that you went through. As I mentioned earlier, a lot of times we're talking about spouses who are caregivers or people that need to be institutionalized, and they have a different kind of caregiver. But, you know, one thing I've learned in the last few years from our family's situation, and I talked a little to Dave about that, is I became more aware than ever. Of course, I knew Tracy and a few caregivers you had, Frank, but I really didn't understand the impact of that until we went through the situation in our family of having to try to find a caregiver that could meet my dad's needs, and then saw how that relationship evolved. And I won't talk a lot about that right now personally, but in your case, do you remember the first caregiver you had and how you felt about the fact that you needed a caregiver? Were you angry at that point? Because like me, I think you and me are both, and a lot of us that are hosts on here, pretty fiercely independent people, used to doing for ourselves. And so it's really a blow to the ego and a shock when all of a sudden we can't and we have to ask for help and rely on someone else for things in our life, although you're still pretty independent. But tell us a little bit about the circumstances of you finding you needed a caregiver, what you needed a caregiver for, and how that worked for you from the beginning and your general feeling about caregivers, because you've had a few.
Thank you, Kim. Unfortunately, you missed a point. I was married when I got trapped in a fire. Unfortunately, my relationship with my wife was headed down a course of divorce. She came back to help me, even though she had broken the marital vow. And people know I'm alluding to. And she was out of my life. But she felt obligated to come back and help me. And she helped me through my first, again, this happened 42 years ago. I'm now 74. So I was 31 when this happened, 73. I'm going to be 70. I can't do math in my head. Anyway, it's
75 in August.
I'm going to be 74 in August.
Oh.
So I will show 73 minus 21. Anyway, it happened about 40 years ago when I got trapped in there. And so she felt obligated to come back and help me. I don't know how long I was unconscious in the hospital. I can't remember. It could be a week, it could be a month. But when I woke up, she was there waiting for me. And she was in a relationship with another guy. But for some reason, she felt obligated to help me through this. And so she attended every doctor's meeting with me. Of course, I couldn't drive. I couldn't go back to work. So she became like my first caregiver. But I knew that this was not going to be long-lasting because she was about ready to divorce me. She ended up getting divorced and married this other guy. Well, flash ahead about, then what happened next was I got my job back at Eastman Color Company. And that took a Herculean part of my effort on my part. I had to do some thinking outside the box. And what happened was, I don't know how much of this stuff you have heard already, but if other people are listening in, this is what I did. I graduated in 1971 from Clarkson College of Technology with a degree in chemical engineering. I started working at Kodak in 1971. When I got trapped in a fire, it was 1981. By 1982 or so, I had recovered fully enough that I kept calling this guy at Kodak. His name was Michael Fubanich. He was in the hiring department or something like that. And he said, Frank, you can't come back to work. I passed all these tests. I had to pass psychological tests. I had to pass. I had to get my driver's license. I did all that. I'm still waiting for him to rehire me. And so then what happened was, because Clarkson College has a large number of clients that are hired, that get hired at Eastman Color Company every year, I knew I could get into this one building without my pants code, which they'd taken from me, right? I went to this meeting with Colby Chandler, who then was the CEO of Kodak. I walked right up to him. I shook his head. I said, hi, Colby. My name is Frank R. Johnson. I'm trying to get rehired. And bam, the next day, I got a call from Michael Fabans. He said, Frank, I don't know what the hell happened, but you got rehired. Come back and fill out your paperwork. I told him the story. He was amazed that I had the determination to go back to work. Unfortunately, what happened, though, was the job I knew how to do before I got injured had to be filled by someone else. So they stuck me in a related department. I languished there for 2.5 years without knowing what I was doing for 2.5 years. And then that was part of the pod division at Eastman Coal Company. It folded because they lost the lawsuit to, who was it? Xerox. Now, who made the instant camera? I can't remember who.
Fuji.
No,
Polaroid.
Polaroid. They had to move me back to another department. Well, I knew the people in this department, too. But I found out the boss was trying to figure out if I could adapt. And the people in this department were related to the department I was working with. I knew half these people. And so after being back for 3 years, they placed me on disability again. So now it's 1975 or 6 when I go back on disability. I want people to realize that when you lose something, you lose a job, or you lose a spouse, you lose a dog, you lose an animal that you have to put down or something like that, there is a void created. And when this void is empty, you fill it up with other stuff that might not be as in your best interest. That's one thing I want people to realize. Because I'm going to get back to that later on. And then what happened, I think by this time, had to be 1975 or so. I met a guy at I saw a shrink, one of these shrinks, and the shrink told me this concept. He let me know if I ever go back to work at Eastman Colcom, they probably aren't going to hire me forever. I'm going to go back. And actually, he said, when I first met him, he said to me, Frank, you probably aren't going to get your job back. I said, what the hell do you mean I'm not going to get my job back? And that shocked me. I looked back at Colcom for 2.5 years. And then when I lost, when a job got taken away from me, I found out about Compeer. Compeer is an organization that matches up men with men, women with women. And I have to be honest with you, I wanted them to match me up with a woman because I wanted to have a relationship with a woman. But that didn't happen. They hooked me up, a guy who became my best friend for about 10, 20 years. His name was Michael Bloom. And Michael filled the hole in my life up to when he died about 4 or 5 years ago. But then what had to happen next was, I think it was sometime in, this had to be 87 or 8 or 9, when I won my award letter from the city of Rochester. They were found to be responsible for my injury. That changed my life. That I now had money to do things like I started buying comic book artwork. I started going out to these seminars. I found Tony Robbins on the TV one night. I joined him up. And so I met Tony Robbins. I can't remember what it was, about 10, 20 years ago. And then I found out about the TBI waiver. The waiver, when I found out about that 22 years ago, and this is about halfway through my life, when I didn't have any kids yet, and let me tell you what happened to me. I fell into this hole. I didn't have any friends. I had friends, but not the kinds of friends that would come out and help me. They'd say, they might come to my house, and they'd probably be single men or something like that, and they would. Single men basically live like pigs. And Dave,
I'm a single guy. It's true.
Single guy. And so what happened, though, was that one day, my dog got out of the house. And he wanted to go out of the house. I opened the door up, and he pulled me down, and I broke my wrist. And I laid on the ground for about 5 or 10 minutes. Somebody called the ambulance. I went to the hospital. I had to have my arm, my wrist in a bandage. Well, what happened was that Wednesday night, I had the pastor's father take me out to a meeting at church. I asked for help. I said, I need help because a nurse had come to my house. She took one look at my house. She said to me, Frank, you can't live like this anymore. I said, what the hell do you mean I can't live like this anymore? Just because I had enough papers on the stove, if someone turned the stove on, they would burn the house down. Just because she didn't have any place to sit, everything had been filled up with papers, with comic books, with comic book artwork and stuff like that. Just because there was poop on the floor I didn't pick up for my dog, just because there was crap growing in my refrigerator, if I ate that stuff, I could have died.
Mm-hmm.
So then what happened, the church came here. The church people came 1 week later. They cleaned out my entire house. What happened during this time was I met a woman at the church who said to me, Frank, do you know you have a traumatic brain injury? I said, no one has ever told me I had this traumatic brain injury. No one ever gave me a diagnosis of having a traumatic brain injury. They just said I was lucky to survive this fire. Of course, I didn't have any burns on my body. I have a bit of a hand movement, which I can't control. I have writing problems, and of course, I do have a damaged vocal cord. Those are the main things that people see. but they can't see my brain, how it operates, how it's been. The neurons in there have been reprogrammed somehow that I seem to make a lot of mistakes in judgment. I'm not doing things the right way. I'm not keeping myself up. And so what I did next was he introduced me to a woman who was working at an agency. I can't remember which agency it was. Probably Center for Disability Rights in Rochester. And then she hooked me up with service. I started getting service about 20 years ago. Over the time, I've had maybe, think about this, you have a service coordinator who visits you once a month. The service coordinator, you work up a plan with them, how much help you need. Well, I need a lot of help with me. I need help figuring out how to be encouraged to take a bath every night. I wasn't taking a bath every night. How to make sure that the laundry didn't pile up. How to make sure I ate properly. I cleaned up the food. And so what they did then was they set up this goal plan for me. And if I'm talking too fast, just tell me to slow down. Dave, if I'm talking too fast, you have to say,
okay,
take a breath, Frank, and calm down. You still have an hour and a half left for the show.
You're doing fine.
Okay. Well, then.
You're fine.
Let me take a drink of water here for a moment. I know that when you're on the radio, they don't want to have any long pauses because somebody could tell you that they say, no one's here, they should leave.
Right.
Well, hang on. While you're taking the drink of water, I just want to say to the folks, and you correct me if I'm wrong, because there might be people out there who also really don't know that they qualify for help. They may or may not know they need it, but they don't qualify. So normally you gave the name of a place in Rochester, but is it normally a social worker of some kind or someone from Health and Human Services or a disability agency, and whoever it is comes out and does an evaluation on you, right? And that you were starting to say they determine what kind of help you need. And I imagine some of that has to do with the ADLs, the activities of daily living, and you mentioned a couple of those, feeding, dressing, toileting, you know, there's like five
care,
or six.
So not realizing that you are alone. So if you don't take a bath in 3 or 4 days, you don't have to get dressed up to be at a job, and you don't think you stink and stuff like that.
Right.
That's what happens. You get a mindset of where you lose your professionalism if you have a professional job like I did.
Right.
Daisy.
Got it.
Thing right to all this. Well, anyway, so I was going to say something else, but you house on fire. That's a new technique. I have to do patches and drop. I'm trying to remember what I was going to say.
They did an evaluation, determining what kind of help you needed.
In answer to your question, most hospitals today know that if a patient has a TBI, they're in the hospital, they're in a car accident, they get shot in the head, they get shot, they get beat up, they get hit in the head. But even if a baby is born with umbilical cord wrapped around them, they know that they're going to have a problem, a challenge later on. And so the hospital has to let the patient know. But usually what happens is, depending on the people surrounding the person, they don't want to give him up to some agency. They think they can take care of him. But unfortunately, this happened 40 years ago. I don't think the hospital had any kind of protocol to assign me to a person. They did assign. I used to see a shrink, but the shrink never said I had a traumatic brain injury. I'm talking about this woman about 5 to 10 years later. And I'm just saying, so a person who has a traumatic brain injury today, if they got one in the last 5 or 10, 20, 15 years, let's go back that far. When they left the hospital, somebody at the hospital should have called them up and said, checked up on them and said, how are you doing? If you aren't doing right, you have these options to get into something called the TBI waiver or to get some kind of help at home. But this is happening in a lot of tests. I know there's people who used to attend. We used to have a monthly TBI meeting in Rochester. I don't think we had one for 2 years because of COVID. They want us to go on Zoom, which I swear no one does that Zoom crap anymore. And I'm just saying that I don't want to Zoom a call. I want to be in live presence with a person. I feel that is the best thing to do. You can evaluate a person's state by looking at them, by what they're doing with their eyes, what they're doing, are they looking down, are they making eye contact, and you can make a better relationship than you can even on a Zoom call. Mm-hmm. A Zoom call, it's like, it's not as personal. It's not to me as personal. And when I go to those meetings, I used to connect with people a lot better. Well, anyway, to make this story even, when or to qualify to have this service, you might want me to mention this too. What you have to do is, first of all, you have to prove that you have a TBI. That wasn't hard in my case. I had to go and get some records from my doctor, which he had, that said, yes, I had almost died from carbon monoxide poisoning, and that's considered TBI. Lack of oxygen to your brain caused the TBI. The next thing you have to do is, momentarily you have to qualify to do this. And when I join them up, the maximum amount of money you should have was something like $750. This is 20 years ago. They raised it up slightly during the past 2 weeks. It had to be less than $750 because now, this past year, they have raised the minimum that you can get from $899 to $1,549. And the reason they did that was they gave out so much, people with Social Security got such a big jump, they wanted to make this minimum higher. And the reason for all this mismatch is if you made more than the minimum, the maximum amount of money, you had to pay it out of your own pocket unless you could set up a trust. Mm-hmm. When you're under 65, which I was, I had a personal trustee. Well, anyway, so they had to get the bulk of my money. It's called the overage. It's the spin down. That term I learned from my computer friend, Michael Bloom, who died. I didn't know what he used to do, spin down every month. I said, Michael, what is this spin down for? He said, in order for him to qualify for Medicaid and Medicare, which he had to do because he...
I don't know if you dropped the phone, but a spin down keeps you... Yes, his call dropped, so I guess he'll call back in. We won't have him explain it again. A spin down is basically spending down your income to the point it's near nothing and you can qualify for Medicaid and the help services associated with Medicaid. So, Frank, I see that I'm not sure why your call dropped, but I just explained what a spend down was, so you don't need to explain that. You're spending down your money to virtually nothing so that you can qualify for Medicaid and get the services allowed for caregiving, et cetera. And I used to help people in my career, believe it or not. insurance products, health insurance related type products, are another method that people buy these products, and it counts as part of the spend down. But anyway, moving on to after the spend down, then you are eligible for the benefits and you're back on the air now. But when your call dropped, I explained the spend down. So go on from
I
there.
I got bumped off. We didn't hit any button. It's probably the connection thing. The universe is trying to send us a message that I want to be talking about certain things. I don't know why I'm teasing you. For all I know, it just could be an aberrant.
Just Martians. It happens.
It's Martians.
It happens.
Well, then what happened next was my service coordinator met with me, and she proposed I have 3 or 4 different options. I could go to a daycare program. I once was enrolled in a daycare program. The problem with the daycare program was that they used to teach you how to plant flowers, how to do rudimentary things like crossword puzzles. My mind wasn't that fancy there. I'm a fairly high intellectual person. I could be asked to add some number stuff. I was doing number calculations before Dave got here. And Rosario was here, and she was amazed. She couldn't even add these numbers. I'm telling you, I had to double these. She's trying to answer these numbers. She couldn't even do them as fast as I could do them. I'm just trying to say, so the people that they had me work with were, I hate to say this, they weren't, I'm looking for a term that's not going to be derogatory. They, perhaps you can help me figure out over. I want
here,
to say
I
this.
Think
okay.
I can help you with that. It just wasn't your deal. You know, when people have
it
a traumatic brain injury, it manifests in a lot of different ways. Some people, it would be helpful for them to go to that daycare because their minds have been more affected. And so, you know, to do things like work crossword puzzles and some of the things you mentioned helps keep people's minds sharp. But your mind, you had an engineering degree. You didn't have a problem with your mind, but because of your speech, they may have gotten confused and not equated the fact that because you had a speech impairment, that you had a brain impairment, which was a big mistake. They didn't know about that then.
The reason I'm telling you about this is that is one of the services that you could qualify for. It's called the daycare program. Well, I started going
right.
That worked. Next thing I know was I started getting help at my house. And for years, I still get help with a CIC, that stands for Community Integration Counselor. She is my shrink. Now, why I need to have a shrink is every day, I have a different problem, a different challenge, a different thing that I have to talk to them about how to handle it. It's not the same problem. It's a different, but it all stems from my being a human being. And if you're human, you're going to have problems that you didn't think could happen. And Daisy's looking at me like Gary said, yes, I know what he's going to say. I think I know where to go with that. Anyway, so I have a shrink. I call her my CIC, and they gave me 2 hours a week when I started with her. She has been, I've gone to 6 or 7 of them in the past 10-12 years, and the one I've been with right now, she's been my shrink. I hate to call it shrink. She's been my psychiatrist, my psychologist, my therapist for at least 7 years. It'd be better to express it. Then next, they give you a ILST, it stands for Independent Release Skills Training, if you want. Now, again, you can pick and choose if you want to have one. But what they do is they set you up with a goal plan. Do you want to, what do you want to make? What do you want to do with the rest of your life? Well, my idea was to become a motivational speaker. They had no idea about how to do that. And they did set me up where I gave some of my first speeches at a place in Rochester called Prelude. Prelude was a day program. They did this day program. They did this easy program. And I went to a hip-hop center and did one or two by this time. Then they have a third party called the HCSS, that stands for Home and Community Services, HCSS. I don't know what the SS said. Do you, Dave? Home and Community Services.
Yeah, I can't remember.
Well, anyway, Dave was one of my HCSS workers. We're supposed to start talking about it soon. Now, the workers that get the grunt work, they have to do, let me go back to the IRSTs. The IRSTs, they aren't there forever. And I kept making my goal so low that by the time they came up for review, I kept saying, well, I know what to do next. You have to make me publish a book. You know how the hell to do that. Of course they do not have to do that. You know how to get a comic book made. No, they don't know how to do that. And I kept using these people for years, trying to help them get me certain goals done. And to this day, I've had a problem, a challenge recently with a couple of my IRSTs. And so right now, I'm not getting any IRST service, but they have to start doing it soon. They're trying to find a new one. But what happened to the general IRSTs is their pay grade is higher than HCSS because they have to have a college degree. 99% of people have college degrees, and they get paid more money because they think they can do things that HCSS workers can't do. And then I don't know what that looked like. What was that shaking your head? What
I'm just thinking of, you're giving me ideas of what to talk about.
Okay, thank you.
Anyway, sorry to distract you.
No, I'm trying to figure out, I'm trying to read Dave and see if I'm getting him angry or upset.
No, not at all.
Well, part of it might be too, Frank, is it change, you know, the system's a little different in each state, and you've given a great synopsis of the paces that you have to go through in order to get home help that you need. But why don't we, talk a little bit about the help?
Okay, let's talk about the help. But the number of IRSTs I've had in 20 years is probably about 20. How many home and health care aides do you think I've had in the past 20 years when they have to fill me 31 hours a week?
That's a good question, why you've had so many, what you would attribute it to.
Well, Dave, I think you'd be a question and answer if you know you.
As an aide, well, I know the answer. I've been through so many of them. Well, as you can see, I mean, Frank is a very, and he, in fact, there was another aide he had to throw out yesterday, and I haven't seen Frank in a few weeks because I've started I'm starting another job as a trucker, so I had to give in my 2 weeks to him, which has passed. But I came to meet with him yesterday to talk about kind of plan what we're going to discuss on your show. And he had a young aide that came for the first time and they hit it off. Frank doesn't tend to have a high tolerance for dummies. And I'm sorry to say there's a lot of people that aren't really motivated in this field, think that it's going to be an easy job.
It's like having a baby.
Right. And this guy came here thinking because Frank had a TBI, he probably wasn't a very seasoned aide, it sounds like. Came here and he saw the movies and said, hey, let's watch a movie. He kept saying, let's watch a movie. And Frank wanted to have a conversation with him. So Frank finally said, okay, watch this. And as soon as the movie started, Frank noticed the guy was right on his cell phone texting. And Frank's like, wait a minute, I thought you wanted to watch a movie with me. And
learn something and be talking about that and
right
with me.
Right. And this guy was kind of, you know, Frank saw through it. The guy wanted to talk to his girlfriend or surf the internet or anything but engage with his client. And I mean, I will say this, if I owned an agency like the one that I used to work through for Frank, I would have a very strict, as strict a cell phone policy as my trucking company had with me, where if we had a camera on us when I drove truck, and if you touched that phone and the camera caught you, bring that truck back, turn in your keys, turn in your badge, you're done. No questions asked. I really think unless it's an extreme emergency, it's very important that the aide be engaged with the patient. It's a job, and so many of them treat it like it's not important, not that these people, you know, these are people with lives. These are people. Frank's a variant. Even if you're not.
If you have notes. About
well, and Frank, let me interject something right there, Dave and Frank, just for a minute, a personal thing, because it is important, and I want to get both of your takes. You kind of just gave them, but, you know, my dad had Parkinson's. Now, the fact that you have a mobility problem, his brain was sharp as a tack, okay? Sharp as yours, Frank. So certainly, you know, had been in sales and mixed well with people. And when he had to start getting caregivers about 5 years ago, one of the things that really bothered me is, yeah, you know, when you have a mobility issue, you need help getting up, help in the shower with some of those ADLs. But these guys, and there were probably five of them, he didn't have them as long as you did, so he didn't burn through as many as you did. But every one of these guys, when they weren't directly helping him do something physically, like if they'd put him in the recliner and turn on the TV or whatever, or set him at his computer and he'd be working on his computer, and they were constantly on their telephone. And I wanted to say something each time, but my folks went through so many caregivers that were just really dummies, like what you guys were saying. You know, they just weren't even good at the mobility part, you know. My mom was afraid they were going to drop him, things like that. So when they found a couple that were actually good at that part of their job, they put up with a lot of shit that I wouldn't have, just because they were afraid to lose these guys, because they could do a few of the important things. But I thought it was so rude. You know, I asked them every time I came to visit, these guys were on their cell phones. And I said, are they always like that? And my folks said, always, you know, unless they're helping them to the bathroom or to the car, take him to a doctor appointment, do something like that. Yep. You know, and they were there 24/7 splitting up two guys, splitting up two shifts, and they were on their phone most of that time. So when you said, Dave, and then back to, I'm going to ping pong back to you, Frank, because this is very important for, it's where our ship has sailed, but when people are doing that, what you said, Dave, is it's their job. If you were at any other job and your face was in your cell phone for 3/4 or more of the time you were punching the clock for that job, your ass would get fired. But a lot of people, Frank, who are in a vulnerable position, who need that caregiver, will often let him get away with some things they shouldn't be, because they're afraid to lose them, that they won't be able to find a new one. Now, one thing we've heard out of you is that you've always seemed to be able to find a new one. But the other thing is, you addressed this right away in one day, right?
Well,
you addressed it.
Guy knew he could be. Yeah, it was one of my problems. And he snickered me. He shook at me. He shot me.
Yeah.
We talked about 2.5 hours before he came to the house. And then he tried to chummy up to me by saying how much he enjoyed, and he was a young guy. He's about 26. He made Arnold Schwarzenegger look like a pansy, basically. And he said he made some money in the stock market. I just thought things, which got my attention. I want them to assign me a person who knows how to make some money in the stock market that isn't happy making $15 an hour, $20 an hour, doing something that is routine like this. I want. Right. And he said he was an entrepreneur. He said he wanted to help me. Well, then what happened was I brought him in the house. He saw all of these movies. I said, well, I usually show my incoming staff, 4 movies. Which one would you want to see? And it is a choice. Fireproof, Change Contender, Pay It Forward, or The Girl Next Door. He wanted to see The Girl Next Door because he's a guy.
I bet.
The Girl Next Door has a hot babe in there. And I said, okay, I'm going to watch this movie, but you have to pay attention because there's going to be times at which I'm going to say, this is the reason I'm trying to get you to watch this movie. I'm trying to teach you something. And within, I set the movie off, and I'm sitting and watching this guy. And the moment the movie starts, he starts texting and tick-tocking on his phone. It went on for 5 or 10 minutes. I said, but this is my problem. My problem is that when you have been warned about this, he's been warned about this from his job. His job said, Frank doesn't like people that do that. And to me, I go nuts. Hell, if I have to rage at you, I'm going to rage at you. I rage at him, and he ends up losing. And that becomes my fault. And I usually have to talk these people out. And when I was talking to Rosario about this earlier, before Dave got here.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Rosario, she was with me for 9 or 10 years.
She's a great aide.
She left the agency because of internal problems within the agency. Not because of me. I hire her separately. She works with me privately, but not as many hours as Marvelous Michelle does. And that's the other person she wanted to mention that. Well, then what happened was, I kept saying, Rose, did you remember the time I tossed you out of the house? She said, you didn't really toss me out. I don't know why you used the word tore out of the house. It's not like I physically tore out of the house. But I get so enraged, I feel like getting them thrown out of the house. I never throw anybody out of the house. But that's one thing that you have to watch. I have to watch the words I say. She remembers when she hit a button in me, I was so scared that she was going to be sitting out in their car, calling up the agency saying, Frank Johnson got out of control again. I've been working with him for 3 years. And I called up the agency. I shot myself in the foot because then the agency said, we don't know what the hell you're talking about. Because I had this happen with everybody else. Everybody else I toss out. They usually call the agency. Within 2 minutes, I get a call from the agency. Like happened when I toss out this guy the other day. I usually tossed out. I didn't toss him out. Hell, if I hadn't told him out, I'd be dead. He weighs 250 pounds. He looks like he's a bodybuilder. He could kill me. He could beat me up.
Well,
I couldn't pick him up, basically. I'm just saying that. Well, anyway.
No, I get it. You know, my dad needed to have somebody like that, a gorilla like that, because if you're a fall risk, you need somebody that's got that kind of muscle. But I wouldn't have been afraid. You know, it was all I could do to not bite my tongue out of my mouth every time I was there, because you know me. And you're right. One responsibility of the person who is getting the care is that, you know, these people are people and they're doing you a service, and so learning to select your words and the way that you deliver them is really important. But I understand, you know, the anger and the rage. Now, I don't know about, it did strike me the first time I saw it, you know, but by the 20th time I saw it, I was ready collar. I don't care how big he was, and I'm 5'2" and quite a bit smaller, but ask him what in the hell he thought he was doing for a living, you know, and take his phone away. In fact, I told my mom at one time when she was saying something about one of the two of them, and both of them did it, always on the telephone, that what she ought to do is have them drop it into a tray right when they walked in the door for work.
Yeah,
and,
absolutely.
You know, if they get a break, you know, and they need to call home to their wife or call home to their kid, you know, give them a 15-minute break or however long a break is, you know what I mean? And then they put the phone right back in until they're ready to leave for the day. But she, you know, like I say, in my folks' case, they weren't, they were too worried about losing this person because they were very hard to come by. This was also during COVID, Frank, and so people weren't racing to do these jobs. So when you found someone who was capable of that kind of girth, you know, to be able to handle what he did need, they were afraid to call him on what really was taking advantage and opportunistic. And I saw a lot of that kind of behavior, but it wasn't mine to be able to correct. If they would have quit over something I said, then my parents are the ones that would have suffered. So it was a really difficult situation to be in. I will tell you, if I ever see the one guy on the street now, I'll knock him out. But so
I will say that patients should be our clients, I should say, I'm sorry, should be very fussy on who they pick, because Frank's not afraid to fire people.
When I first was told
about him by Lily, because I had a patient that was very difficult, and his issue was he wanted girls, but he would get really touchy, grabby, feely with the girls, and they didn't want to work with him, understandably. So they'd stick him with a guy.
Yeah.
And your nurse Natasha, or your aide Natasha, actually knows him, and when she realized I had a problem, he goes, "He didn't like you because you're a white guy. I know him," you know, which I suspected, you know, it was a race thing. So aides will run into that. You know, he was an older black man that probably dealt with very real racism, probably had to sit in the back of a bus and probably wasn't allowed in certain restaurants. He was that age. So I'm sure I probably triggered him, not my intent, but it does happen in this industry. But they told me about Frank, said, "Yeah, you know, you'll like this guy, you know, and he'll like you." And they were right, you know, on both counts. We're both comic geeks. They didn't know that about me, but politically, spiritually, we have similar beliefs and values. And they told me he's an amazing man, you know, and he is. And I mentioned that to Frank. I said, "Yeah, I really like you. Lily really liked you." And he goes, "Well, I'll bet you she doesn't think I'm an amazing man now, because I fired a whole lot of people after you and I worked together." And and Frank's not too gentle about it. I will just say this, and I know it's easier said than done for someone with a TBI, because of the three patients I had, and Frank's the one I worked with the longest now, they do get triggered, and they do have kind of hair trigger tempers and locked onto an idea. And when they fire someone, it's hard for, you know, like Frank, my advice to him would be keep your cool or you'll be seen as a troublemaker, but easier said than done.
I know.
Because I've tried calming him down one time when he has a great aide, he mentioned a Rosie, and they had a disagreement about a scheduling conflict with her and I, and she called him up and said, asked him, "Frank," because he had her on speaker, I was in the room.
Oh, Lord, geez,
okay.
I think that was
really? Okay. Well, anyway, it was, you know, he got triggered and he flew off the handle, and I was trying to calm down. I was like, "Frank, you don't want to lose your good aide," because he was so angry.
And
I
said, "Shut up."
Well, you weren't that bad.
I wanted to say,
I'm in this mood. I don't care what the hell happens. And then after
you need to interrupt
that,
the pattern.
After I said that, I was very smart. I ran
straight
down.
Yeah, well, he knew her well enough to know she'd call back. Because I said, Frank, I'm afraid you just lost your age.
I said, watch.
He goes, you don't know us. She'll call back. And sure enough, she did. And when she answered the phone, she just laughed. She didn't even say anything. He said, hello. And she just laughed. And she goes, oh, Frank, I love you. And then he started laughing. And prior to that, he hung up the phone. He was cursing. And then he yelled at me. He says, look, pattern interruption I need. You need to interrupt the pattern. I studied with Tony Robbins. I said, okay, how do I interrupt that pattern? I don't know. Take a glass of cold ice water and pour it over my head. I said, yeah, that's just what I need to do.
Get you need to be in jail for
assault and battery of an elderly patient.
Well, I might make a suggestion because, again, I understand the getting angry, but we do have to be responsible for ourselves, and we can't blame it on Anthony Robbins or blame it on our TBI. What I would recommend to the shrink, when you said that, you know, I call mine a shrinkette because it's a chick, but, you know, you get one of those no matter what, whether you need it or you don't. They're just assuming since your life has changed that you need one. And I'm not saying it's bad. It's actually very good. If you have loved ones, it pays to have someone that gets paid for you to dump all your crap in their lap. They signed up for that job. And that way you're not giving it to your loved ones and the people that are around you. But I would write this down and recommend it to your shrink when you talk to them next, is that one of the things that would be good for you, it was very good for me, is something called either CBT or DBT. And these are cognitive behavior. Yeah, cognitive behavior therapy. And instead of just talking, you know, what sometimes the shrink will say things, but it's not something that sticks to help you change your behavior and take responsibility for your own behavior so that, you know, someone doesn't have to pour a bucket of cold water over your head, is this teaches you skills. And if the shrink can't offer you something like CBT, then they're maybe not worth their salt. A lot of times those shrinks are just there to dole out medication and not to help you learn skills that are going to make your life better. CBT is what I meant to say. Somebody in the chat room corrected me, but CBT is cognitive behavior therapy. And Frank, I think you'd find it very interesting. I've known you long enough to know how your mind works. And my mind worked this way. When I was introduced to cognitive behavior therapy, I embraced that. Because one of the things is emotion regulation. It's four chapters or four modules, and one of them is emotion regulation. And it teaches you, that addresses exactly what you're talking about. And it gives you tools that you can default to yourself, you know, or it might be something since you like to talk with your caregivers that maybe you would talk a little bit about, you know, instead of the bucket of water over the head, which isn't practical, you know, here's a couple of the things that I'm working on to learn to control, you know, my behavior and not to go into a rage and scare people off, but to be honest about my feelings and confront someone when I think that they're doing something wrong. And maybe...
Yeah.
You know, you can help me with that. It doesn't become the caregiver's responsibility. Ultimately, it's yours. But if they want to know a way to not hit your triggers, then it might be good if they know what you're working on and they can help support your effort. And so can the shrink.
Yes.
Well, thank you for that. Kim, I want to tell you, I'm going to be 74 this year. 2020/74. And by kind of God, I can tell when I'm gonna have like a heart attack, because my throat starts hurting down my chest. And if I haven't taken my Prozac, I know I've missed my medicine. And I can kind of feel when a person's going to trigger me. But for some reason, I haven't been able to cut the dam off and not rage these people and simply say to them, you have to leave, without giving them a big explanation. Without them triggering me, they ask me why I have to leave as he's talking on his phone or something like that. I thought it was good shit. I thought you would get banned from the radio.
Well, Frank, maybe what you could do is text them back and say you're leaving because you can't do your job. You're always here. Send them a text and they'll read it on the phone, right?
I can't send the aide the phone number. They aren't going to give me a phone number. They aren't going to give it to me.
Oh, I see.
So
well, I think then you just ask. Anyway, well, I don't want to interrupt you, but we got like 45 minutes left, so I want to move on from here. But it's a very good point, because I think you do. I'm glad you brought it up, because I've only, run into this other situation, and you were talking about it. Dave was talking about it. Apparently, this is a pretty common thing that when people aren't doing their job, they're on their telephones. And that, society overall has that problem. And now for example, a lot of caregivers and others are thinking they can bring that nasty habit into their job. Well, you don't get paid for that. It would be like if you brought your boyfriend or girlfriend or grandma or somebody with you to your job, and then only paid attention to them. You don't get paid for that.
Yeah, and the boyfriend wound up robbing you while she was tending to you.
Yeah,
Frank had that happen, where a female aide brought a boyfriend, and the boyfriend wound up going through some of Frank's comic collection and prints, which, taking some fairly expensive stuff. And Frank's had that done. And the other thing that infuriates me, and I'm sure it does you too, Kim, when you experience that with your father, is they treat these patients like they're an interruption when they're the purpose of their work. They're not an interruption. And that infuriates me. And I understand there's not a lot of money. There's not. But if agencies paid more, they'd have less aides, but they'd have more quality aides, because I do think that's part of the problem. But the other issue is just it's a societal issue, and it's very easy. One thing that Frank mentioned when I was told about Frank, and that he was a motivational speaker in his comic book collection and the Fantastic Frank persona, I looked up a few videos of him and his friend Marvelous Michelle, who I know she's an awesome lady. And what he made a very profound statement that I found to be absolutely true, as I'm sure you have as well.
It blows my mind. I can't even remember what
he doesn't even remember saying
what
it. We've become a victim culture where people argue over who's more marginalized. But he said, look, there's a huge marginalized group of people people with TBI that anyone can become a member of. At any given day, in an instant, your life has changed. Frank wasn't born this way, and his life was forever changed, as he's already discussed in detail. I know you have as well, and both of you are very intelligent people. And just like that, a lot of doors closed and then were locked, and you had to find other ways to find fulfillment and happiness and be movers and shakers, because I know both you and Frank are the type of people that don't want to be idle. But people very often will, and Kim, you and I have had a conversation about this where you said, because it's not an ailment people can see, people
will disregard you as less than worth.
Yes.
Well, and you brought up something too, Frank, and that's don't ever give money aside from the pay. Don't loan money. Don't give money. Don't leave your money laying around. I've seen Frank get taken advantage of many times over the years. And you mentioned a thing, Dave, you know, about the stealing. I remember when the comic book and a couple things went missing. And, you know, my husband went over to change my mom's printer ink today. And she said, look, I've got the book. Well, they moved from their house into a independent assisted living community. But during the move somewhere, my husband said she handed him the instructions for a printer that was a two times newer printer. And I guarantee you that new printer made it over to the apartment, and they had their own private. They brought the private help with them to the new place. I guarantee you the guy who was on the phone all the time took enough time off the phone to switch out those printers, that he took the newer printer, left the old printer, but didn't take the instructions. And so, you know, you think that they're supposed to be doing a background check if you go through an agency on people. And you'd like to think that's the case, but I'm just shocked in all the years that I've known Frank, and it's not like we talk every day, but the many times, and not just caregiver people, but people who have the, you know, opportunity to meet him, have found ways to pitch him ideas that they know that he'll find appealing because he is a speaker. Mm-hmm. He does like to get speaking gigs. You know, he does love the comic books, likes to do comic book gigs. There's all kinds of things he's capable of doing. So when people find that out, they'll come and pitch him something they'll know he's interested in and want money, you know, in order to help him do it, and suddenly they've got the money and they're gone and haven't fulfilled their part of the deal. So basically they've taken advantage and stolen from him.
Oh, yeah.
But it's a difficult situation, but I will just say, because then I want to pop over to Dave for a minute, Frank, but it's a difficult situation because you want to treat the workers, I understand, they need to be paid more. But again, when we're talking about personal responsibility, they took the job. You know, if they're not up to the job and they're not, you know, up to the job, go get a job at Burger King or somewhere else that pays the same amount, and don't get a job working with people. If you take that job, you live up to your job description. And if you are the client, then you can't treat the person like the hired hand. You've got to treat them with some amount of respect because they're providing a service to you. And if they do something out of line or you've got a problem with something, you can't rage like a maniac and talk to them like they're a dog. You need to be able to say, you know, when you do this, it makes me feel like this. I'm surprised your shrink hasn't gone over it. This is shrink 101, you know. When you're on your phone all the time, it makes me feel like you're ignoring me, and that isn't what you're getting paid for. I'm your client. You're on my clock right now. I would rather talk, work on DBT, go for a ride, do whatever it is that you want that would be beneficial to you, and not watch you on your telephone for the whole time you're on the clock getting paid. Because, you know, then they are getting paid plenty if they're sitting on their ass on the phone. You know,
that's
getting
right.
paid $15 an hour is a lot to be sitting on your ass on the phone for the whole time. You're supposed to
Tim,
be working for somebody.
Tim, if I can interrupt you, but I want to say that is why it's critical that if you find a good aide, that you treat them like gold. And if you aren't treating them like gold, and if you have a fit with them, you have to get over that. You have to give yourself. You have to, hopefully the person is bonding with you enough that they're going to forgive you, like happened with me and Rosie. But the problem comes when Rosie, I think she's going to hear this later. I'm not trying to say she did anything wrong, but she did. She left me after working with me for 9 years, and she had some problems with the agency. It wasn't with me. It was with her own schedule and something else, which I'm not going to share because I don't know the real truth about that.
Mm-hmm.
And so in the interim, when you go from a highly skilled person whom I think in 9 years I might have raged against 3 times, and she took this, and she didn't. I'm not saying she took this worldly, but she forgave me every time. That's what a true Christian would do to another man, another person. A true Christian would turn the other cheek. And
well, and a true Christian would apologize and say,
I was upset
because of this, but I'm sorry for the way that I blew up.
Right.
So, yeah.
Anyway, so in the 2 years that she's been gone, I had days. Dave came here right back after she left, and Dave was working out for me. But then, I don't know if Dave wants to share what happened with us, but there is a different story about, do you want to share that?
I won't get into too big a detail. I've already talked to Kim about it. As I mentioned, Frank wants to be a mover and a shaker, and there was a project I was supposed to do, and we were talking a lot about the Bible and Christianity, because one of the things Frank liked about me as an aide is we could have pretty deep conversations about that stuff. And while it is not appropriate for me to go trying to minister to people, Frank already had an interest in it. So that's how the conversation took place.
Yeah.
So it was not outside.
Sure.
It was not me trying to cram a belief down the road.
Up to him.
Right.
I brought this up.
But anyways, I had a project I was supposed to do years ago that God put on my heart, and I never completed it, and I had some guilt. And Frank misunderstood it, and it was kind of going through a bit of a panic attack because he's involved in funding comics. He's a producer of comics, and it's expensive. And his partner wanted him to come up with a big, big amount of money, and Frank was having a panic attack. And then he found out I was going to do these pop-up books to teach kids Bible stories, and Frank just kind of made the decision, I'm going to pull my money from the comic book and promote your project. So I said, I can't do that, Frank. It would be unethical on so many levels. And second of all, it's too late for me to do the project. It's dead. It's not happening. But Frank kind of locked on to that idea with his heat-seeking missile, and he mentioned it to one of the people.
One of the aides, and
they turned me in. And the IRST turned me into the nurses. And next thing I know, I get a surprise that I'm being accused of giving Frank Johnson financial advice, which I was not. And then when I figured out what it was about, they put me on probation, and Frank flipped out because I was his new favorite aide at this point. And I wasn't too pleased either because I was being accused of something I didn't do. And Frank said, look, it happened just like Dave said, but they didn't take Frank at his word. They assume because he's a TBI, I must be manipulating him. So, and I see that.
No, it was the comic book guy that was doing it. He should have been. Sorry
that
happened. It's good they're trying to keep an eye out, but you definitely weren't doing that.
But in this business,
you're
guilty till proven innocent as an aide.
I have to tell you that it wasn't the guy promoting the comic book guy. I had told the story to my IRST. My IRST finally confess that he's the one who called the
blew me in.
And
Steve.
He quit me 2 weeks after that. He has to come. He isn't with me, which is why I am not a good RLT. I've been starting to get a retention for him for 2 years. Well, anyway. So this
go on, Dave.
Go back. Back to our anybody. It could hurt me. It could hurt Dave.
Well, it's frustrating to me because I have a black mark on my record now that I do not earn, you know, and that's what I will warn Age. You got to be careful what you share with patients. Frank certainly did not do what he did out of animus, obviously, but patients will take an idea and run with it, and I didn't foresee this happening. See, I have to kind of watch your tongue a little bit. I learned the hard way what you share with a patient, with a client, I should say. You know, loose lips sink ships, you know, and I was just telling him about a project, but Frank really wanted to know. And, you know, Frank, I have two patients I worked with a lot, very different. My other patient is very more childlike. She does not have Frank's intelligence, never did. She was born with the condition she has and much more temperamental. I mean, she's triggered all the time. She lives her life triggered. And I realized Frank can still drive. Frank can still mingle. He goes to comic conventions. He's still buying and trading comics and artwork online and has a life. Not as much of a life as he'd like, but he can where my other patient doesn't have a life. Her life is her little apartment, Dunkin' Donuts, Wegmans, and the bank and doctor's appointments and the aides that come and see her. And so one day I remember she was having knee surgery and I didn't have the basket. It was like 3 feet from where she wanted it, the garbage basket. So I came back the next day, and she chewed over that all night and couldn't wait to give me hell for having that waste basket in the wrong spot. And I was pretty new to the profession, and my first thought was, really, this is your big issue? You know, if this is your big issue, you're living a blessed life. I didn't say that, but I was thinking it. But then I had to remember, wait a minute, this is her whole environment. This little apartment,
yeah.
This small, tiny world of hers. So in her world, that is a monumental deal where that waste basket is. And I need to treat it as a monumental issue and be mindful of those little things that aren't little things to her. And once I did, things change. And the temperament thing, Kim, a lot of what you talked about, I learned from a physical therapist that had good luck with her. She just said, hey, pleases and thank yous today. And I started doing that, and people started to notice, hey, she's actually being polite. She's saying, please and thank you. And one day she would, like, bark an order at me, and then she'd groan and say, please. You know, and she looked at me and smiled. She goes, you know, this whole please and thank you thing is really exhausting. I said, well, you know, you said you want people to like you better, right? These old ladies you live with, you want them to not hate you and think and be friendly with you, right? Yeah. Well, that's how it works, please and thank you. Magic words. Have you noticed they're being nicer to you? They're not being as mean? Yeah. I said, please and thank you. Keep it up. Good job, you know. And she did start
to change.
That's excellent. And little things like that. But, you know, these older ladies, though, she shouldn't have been in the place she was at because, you know, they don't, as people age, we don't look as good as we once did. We don't feel as good as we once did. And they had their own issues. And the last thing they wanted was my client coming over and harassing them, you know, wanting a friend, wanting a buddy. And they'd sometimes be mean to her, and then she'd be suicidal. So I had to, talk her out of that kind of
situation. How to get her.
I don't really share names with patients, but Frank saw I was down one day. I said, well, I found out a patient of mine tried to commit suicide, and he asked me if she's a Christian. I said, well, yeah, she is. She has a picture of Jesus. She's a Catholic. Well, there you go. Ask her what she thinks Jesus thinks about suicide. We had a long talk about it, and she was under the assumption that, well, I think God will forgive me. I said, oh, really? Because in the Bible it says otherwise, you know. And I said, I can show it to you. You have a Bible in that house. I'm sure you do. She goes, no, I believe you. I said, I'm telling you right now, that will not be okay with God if you do that. And she really stopped for the rest of the time I was with her. There was no more suicide attempts.
And you weren't a 24-hour caseworker.
No, I wasn't.
Other aides that were with her, I knew some of them.
Oh, really?
They said to me,
she's another one that didn't like people looking at the phone, and she liked me because I looked her in the eye. I took her seriously, and that's all she wanted. She's a person that never got taken seriously her whole life.
I'm looking for a term. She had been this
discriminated?
No, disingenuous. She had been eviscerated by it.
Well, yeah, she's been treated, she's been marginalized. She's part of that marginalized group.
Yes,
that you talked about in your Fantastic Frank seminars. And, it's just little, taking it those things. And one time I had to talk to her because she loved little kids. And their moms and dads, we live in a fallen world, you know. And she'd want to go over and touch the kids and talk to them. And one time she walked right, I had her in a wheelchair. And we were by a mom and her baby, and she just reached over and started, like, patting the kid's leg with her finger, and the mom's looking at her, like, horrified. I said, Billy, please don't do that. And she, I can't say names, but I just told her, please don't do that. And she's like, why? She screamed at me and yelled, I just did nice to that kid, you know. And I said, yeah, but here's the thing. We live in a fallen world. We live in a sick world where kids are being kidnapped. They're being molested, and parents are very protective. They don't know you. They don't know that you're harmless and you just love kids, and it scares them. That mom was scared. I said, you're going to have to promise me that when we're in public, you keep your hands off children. And she wanted to buy a kid a donut at the Dunkin' Donuts. I'm going to go over and just buy that girl an ice cream or a donut. I said, Billy, please don't. And again, she screamed at me, why? And I said, well, because you're going to scare. I told you we had a conversation about children being kidnapped, children being molested. Parents are afraid. We live in a very crazy world, and you just can't do that. And she got it. I mean, she grudgingly accepted my request. And you're going to have to promise me with the kids. I said, you can't do that, at least not when you're with me, and you shouldn't do it with anyone, because it's a very uncomfortable situation. It makes the parents uncomfortable. It makes me uncomfortable. And I'm just going to ask, out of respect for me and out of respect for those moms and dads, not to do that with kids, even though I know you love children and I know you got a good heart, you know. And it's real big to make them feel, if it's someone like her that's more childlike, and there are TBIs, people with TBIs that are more childlike, either born that way or their injury made them that way. Frank is very different, you know, than she is. With him, it's more an issue of compartmentalizing. The emotions can get the better of him. And I think just the frustration of not being able to be the mover and shaker he wants to be, because Frank really wants to be changing the world. It's almost an obsession with Frank.
Right. Yeah.
And Dave, what happened to you? Because you had all the time that you worked as a caregiver helping others.
Yeah.
And then you had a life change of your own, right?
Yeah.
Can you tell us about that a little bit?
I got into driving truck because the girl I was dating at the time was not pleased with my income as a caregiver and wanted me to aim higher. And I said, well, yeah, I need a more serious career. I got into caregiving out of necessity because I had a best friend that was beaten years ago. And during the Rodney King race riots and nearly killed. And over the years, she got worse with my chiropractor. And she was the reason I was able to be a musician again due to a weightlifting injury I had when I was 22. So that's how I got into this. When she died, I had to give up my business because she became such a full-time job, I barely slept and was basically in so much pain. She was losing her mind. And she told me, she was Frank's chiropractor as well. A year after she was dead, we found out Frank went to her shortly before I started seeing her. So we were like ships in the night. And that she said, look, you're going to need work. I said, I don't know what I'm going to do. I don't want to start a business again. And she said, well, get into health care giving. You're good at it, you know, and you got a brain in your head. They'll love you. Most of these aides are dummies. I said, okay. And I enjoyed it. And I was fine with the pay. It's not all about the money. I've done my share of saving for my years of running my own business and have done pretty well by myself. But I needed to get into a career. It was truck driving. Well, a few months into my driving career, I had to slam on my brakes in North Carolina to avoid hitting a car that pulled in front of me right before my delivery. I was doing about 70, hit the brakes, all the stuff on the rear sleeper cab bunk came flying, my guitar, my water bottles, my suitcase, hit me on the shoulder. And I've had nothing but problems with both arms, especially my left arm from the shoulder strap was bloating like a pregnant woman every time I would eat. And my life was changed. I lost my job. I'm in a dispute with them over getting workers' comp so I can at least get an EMG on my arm, and they're fighting it, saying, no, there's no breaking issue. And they deceitfully sent the wrong image of stuff falling off the back, because it would happen a lot if I had to hit the brakes on a ramp sometime. You don't have much room on those bunks for things to fall over, but when I really hit the brakes, that stuff was like right next to me, right on the floor below my gas pedals was a water bottle, and they're just sneaky. But the point is, my life changed, and I've been having a hard time. It's closed a lot of doors. I'm a musician. I'm back to wondering how long I'll be able to play. I can't do a full set anymore, so I'm just doing studio work. And, my life changed immediately. And then was hit by a tractor trailer 4 months after that, caused more injuries, and now I have one of the worst-looking spines I've ever seen, and it changed in the split second. So, again, like Frank said, anyone, including the caregiver, can wind up needing care at some point in their life. And spinal injuries like that can shorten a life dramatically. And so while I don't have a TBI, I do have physical ailments that I didn't need, and have shut some doors. You know, I don't know that I'm going to be able to drive. I can't do cross-country driving anymore like I did over-the-road trucking. There's no way I could drive 11 hours a day, 7 days a week.
Kim,
no.
One question before we go on. Is anybody in the chat room got their hand up?
Yeah.
Wanted to ask me or Dave a question while we're here?
No, we've addressed a couple of questions that were in the chat room, but nobody's calling.
The board, I know I used to run the board. I could see, I don't know what how many people you got in there, and it's a tour, but I just want to make sure that we aren't ignoring anybody that has a question.
Yeah. I mean, I guess my advice when I learn from AIDS, anyone that's thinking of doing this, really keep in mind that a lot of the folks have a small environment, take their environment seriously, because while it may seem like a minute thing, it's a monumental thing to that person, because they don't live in as big a world as the rest of us do.
I had a civil problem happen the other day. Now, Kim, I don't know if you wanted to interrupt me and talk about something else. Oh, where you were.
Well, just for 1 minute, Frank, and then I'll let you, because we got like 20 minutes. But I do want to stop for just a second, because you and Dave just brought up a couple good points. And Dave, by being the caregiver for so long and then having a shift in his life, that none of us, you know, we all have our life, our dreams, our aspirations, and in the snap of a finger, our lives can completely change. And so, you know, tonight, for those of you who might have come in late, we've been talking about the caregiver, survivor, or client situation, the dynamic, and being responsible, each party being responsible, you know, the caregiver being responsible for their job description and treating the client with respect. And at the same time, the client treating the caregiver who's providing them with a really valuable service they can't do anymore with respect, because you never know when you as the caregiver might wind up being a client, a survivor, and need help. You know, it's kind of the same thing. I interview doctors who really don't know anything about TBI, and they come on and talk about it, and their perspective changes a lot. I have some doctors who now are TBI survivors, and what they're telling patients now is a lot different now that they've gone through it themselves than what they read in their textbook when they didn't know what it felt like or what people dealt with on a day-to-day from a bottle of Vicks. So it is important, and you guys both bring up a good point of being in tune to what the other person's needs are. And then, Frank, Dave, the point that you brought up, you know, when people think about it, that everybody's different and their needs are going to be different, and you should never assume or treat everyone the same. In Frank's case, he's got an engineering degree, and like you said, is a mover and a shaker, a very intelligent guy. But because of a speech issue, people might make assumptions. And other people, I gave examples of people that have mobility issues or other issues. People assume something else. They read something else into that, like about a person's thought process or something like that isn't true at all. It's just something that people link together. So this is a good way to raise awareness too, because somebody might not walk like you or talk like you, because somebody's different than the status quo doesn't mean that their special needs are how an outsider might interpret them. So listen and learn before you assume on anything. And Dave, when you talked about the gallon or garbage can, I seeing somebody who is very active, an A-seated tennis player through age 66, wiping the court with people that were 40 years old, and a type A salesperson, just totally active 100% of the time, to get struck with one of the cruelest diseases in the world for that kind of a personality, the world gets much smaller.
Yes.
And so it means I've got to pray, you know, I pray about resentments. One of my personal things while you guys were talking about that is I guess I'm going to have to put in another prayer for that caregiver that I want to knock out someday, because, you know, the things that you mentioned, Dave, about his world being smaller and how frustrating that is. That little thing, you know, when you can't, let's say you were a controlling person, or you were able to take control of most of the things in your life, and then suddenly you couldn't. Then little things. I remember, just real quick, like, I'll give you an example. When I had my brain injury and I couldn't do anything for the better part of a year, I was a month in, and I had been in coma for 11 days in the hospital for a while. Then I was out, and it was like a couple weeks out of the hospital, you know, people had been kind enough to send all kinds of cards and teddy bears and flowers and things to the hospital. And my mom had a stack of thank you notes. Well, nobody expected me. I mean, my brain aneurysm had ruptured and nearly killed me. Nobody was expecting a thank you note 2 weeks out of the hospital, right? But like a rabid dog, a rabid pit bull around some raw meat, hungry, I got out those thank you notes one day because I couldn't do anything else, okay? I get out the thank you notes, and I start trying to write the thank you notes, and I'm messing up words and making mistakes, and I'm getting really frustrated, and I'm tearing up the thank you notes, throwing them on the floor. But I was determined. I was just freaking determined. I was going to write out those thank you notes. You know, and I didn't know till years later that it was because everything in my life was out of control. And the only thing that I could try to control in that moment was the thank you notes and the pen. and sitting at the table trying to do the thank you notes. So, you know, you, and that gal with her garbage can, you know, suddenly her world was small. And it is, I know why you thought what you thought, but I'm glad that you processed it and realized because, you know, a lot of people just see people how they are now. And first of all, they don't think that much of it because they're basically thinking about their own life and their own stuff and making a quick snap judgment off of an observation. You know, but if they really thought about it, that most of the time people didn't have these challenges their whole life. And it could
That's
be
right.
you tomorrow. You know, it
you
could
got
be
it.
You tomorrow. So, you know, giving people the benefit of the doubt and trying not to make assumptions and listening and learning, because those lessons will serve you well, whether it's a shift in your own life or someone in your family. And we all know someone in our family at some point in time or ourselves who have gotten in an accident, who have gotten in a disease. As I have said to a number of people a number of times, and I'm not trying to be smart, but none of us makes it out of here alive. You know,
That's right.
some go quickly and they don't have to even go through this topic we're having tonight. It never comes up. But for the rest of the bulk of the people, there's going to be at some time a caregiver needed for someone who's a survivor, even if they're just aging out, you know. And that's something we all have to go through in one way, shape, or form. So, you know, I think a lot of people, well, they did in the old days, and then I'm going to shut up and we're just going to wind it up, but because we have 10 minutes. But, you know, in the old days, anybody who is different, what we're trying to do is keep society evolving in a positive way. In the old days, whenever anyone was different, I'm writing a book now and I won't go into that, but it has to do with this, is that, you know, anyone who is different, if they talk different, if they walk different, even somebody who had epilepsy, for example, anybody who is different and made the status quo feel uncomfortable, maybe some people in wheelchairs made them feel uncomfortable, or someone who was an amputee made them feel uncomfortable. All these people were locked away in institutions. I'm talking back in mid-1800s to mid-1900s. Asylum-type places. A lot of people didn't have a mental problem at all. They were just different from the status quo, made the status quo feel uncomfortable, so they tucked them away so that nobody had to deal with them on the outside or be troubled with trying to understand it. And the whole thing that closed down that system was overcrowded, underpaid, understaffed. You know, and now they're arguing. You hear a lot of people talking about mental health and different things these days. And, you know, what the answer is what the problem was. Three things. Understaffed, underpaid, overcrowded. Fix those three things, and you're going to go, that's the fix to the system. You know, to me, I'm just kind of sitting here scratching my head because they've gone over 100 years. They've gone from the 1800s with this attitude where they locked people away, and now, for God's sake, it's worse. You know, we've got tent cities. The people are right in front of your face. And we've gotten so callous that we can just step over them and keep texting on our phone or talking on our phone and just ignore. I mean, that's really bad. At least in the old days when something made you feel uncomfortable, you put them out of sight, out of mind. And that was terrible. Today, they're right in our face and we aren't doing anything about it. And places aren't being funded anymore. When you have rehabilitation housed in a nursing home, that's not good. You know, that's not a good environment. You've got a lot of people rehabbing, and that's not an environment. You know, what people in rehab need is a positive environment, a hopeful environment, an energetic environment, and that's exactly what they're not getting. I used to volunteer in a nursing home, and there was a group of kids in rehab, and what a weird mix, you know. And yet, when I broke my femur back in 1977, the rehab was in the hospital. You know, there was a floor that was rehab, and then all of a sudden, I don't know when it was somewhere I was oblivious, they took rehab out of the hospital and stuck it in nursing homes. And so, you know, there's some things. When you guys go out and vote, I would ask some serious questions to your representatives. What is their plan for helping vulnerable groups of people, whether it's disability, mental or physical? What is their plan? Yeah. And if their plan doesn't include, go ahead.
I was just going to say, now that's one marginalized group that doesn't get pandered to by the politicians, I've noticed. Yeah. They don't pander to people that you're talking about. And I've gotten to know a few of them in Streets for Christ ministry. One is a doctor, Dr. Mark. He used to work for the U.S. government, and he has paranoid schizophrenia. And very intelligent guy. When I first met him, like, ooh, this guy's college educated. And as it turns out, he's a doctor. He was a very well-respected doctor. My friend Dr. Esty, who's the person I was taking care of, who was Frank's chiropractor, was deathly afraid of becoming homeless. The only reason she wasn't homeless is I took her into my home, but she didn't always have the best environment, because the difference is when I worked for her, I lived with her. There was no escape, so it often affected. I would get exhausted, frustrated. It was very hard for her and for me, where, with the case of most AIDS, we get to go home to our lives afterwards. And that's all the more reason why they should be more attentive why they're there, because they always will have time for that phone. But it shouldn't be while they're working with that patient. It's amazing how quickly some of these people in the tent cities, like you were talking about, Kim, they're college educated. A lot of them are. They're not all high school dropouts or people that were born slow or drug addicts. A lot of them may have become drug addicts, but some of them were very, very well. Some of them were CEOs or middle management at Kodak. These people had lives. They were movers and shakers, a lot of them, and now they got nothing.
Absolutely. They're not funding it.
Young police officers. Yep.
Yeah, they're not funding it. And so, again, you know, what I would say, and I talked to a, I'm going to tell you real quick, this was a place that was a community living for adolescents with disabilities. And there was a big scandal. I won't talk about that. We don't have the time. In Iowa, just across the bridge from where I am, hit the news. DOJ or whoever came to investigate it. Apparently there had been a lot of complaints similar that had gone under the wire, but they were doing human experimentation and sexual experimentation on these kids.
Wow.
And it got caught, and they were going to close the place down. It's going to take 2 years to close the place down. But then I got a hold of one of the residents and talked to the resident, long time, nice young man. And he told me that each of these places has several scattered across the state. And 3.5 hours away, there was building number one, and that was older, and the same kind of stuff happened there. But that what they were really doing, you know, the governor had written a big, got a big photo op and piece in the newspaper about this great plan she had to reform the whole system. And I talked to two different people. One was the resident who told me, no, they're not doing that. They're going to be moving most of us, just moving us to building one when this one closes down. So really, sleight of hand, they were just moving them to an older, worse place that had the same kind of complaints. And then I talked to the guy who was the superintendent who got fired, one of the people who got fired under this deal. He said because of all these lawsuits that are flying, he couldn't really tell me anything, but he would send me an article, and that I sounded like a bright person to read the article carefully. And there'd be one line that would stick out to me. Well, I read the article, and it was about the governor's new plan. And the one line that was in there, after all this fluff and stuff about how we're going to fix everything, da-da-da-da, it was an election year. She did get reelected. And I liked her before. And this ain't the only lady, okay? This is going on all over the country. But the plan was written out. But she did not seek funding. So as long as it's not funded, it ain't happening. No matter what you write down on a piece of paper, if there's not funding, it's not happening. Hang on 1 second. The gal's telling me we have 60 seconds, so we are going to go into just a little bit of overtime, but for those of you who want to hear, you can dial in to 424-243-9540. Got to do it right away, 424-243-9540. For the rest of you, I'd like to say thank you so much for being here tonight. Fantastic Frank Johnson and Dave. Say your last name, Dave, quick.
Prosco.
Have been my guest tonight. We've been talking about survivors and caregivers, and I want to thank you all for listening and being here, and I will be back next Wednesday night, same time, same place. I really appreciate you, and have a great week.
Thanks.
Okay, now we can finish what we were talking about and just wind it up. Okay. So, anyway, I think we're still on the air. We're still on the air now.
5 seconds or 10 seconds?
I'll explain it to you later. We're in a little bit of overtime now. It quits streaming live when the clock runs out. But in the on-demand, when people click that link tomorrow, they'll hear the show in its entirety without a break. So, but the people that were on live needed to either call in or they quit hearing a couple of seconds ago. So we're not going to go on much longer. I don't want to end a show in the middle of a sentence, you know, before we've made our point and said our goodnight. So we're going to do that. But anyway, I thought that that was a travesty, that a great plan was written out about, you know, how to help and make sure these situations don't ever happen again, but no source of funding had been sought. And so, again, I guess, you know, if you all got to write it down, underfunded, understaffed, overcrowded has been the problem with treating people with disabilities, whether they're physical or mental health. Well, my book goes back starting in the beginning of the 1800s up to current in this thing that happened in the last year in Iowa. and has happened in other places around the country. So we've gone on that long with nobody, and then I won't even give away any political persuasion here, because Democrats and Republicans are both guilty. So they've found other places to spend the money and other agendas. But if you care, you know, if you're part of this community and you care about the people living out on the street, or you care about being able to get help yourself and keep the roof over your head and be able to get those services, then the only way that's going to happen, because vulnerable groups of people can't advocate for themselves, you know? I'm not saying that one person can't make a difference. Sometimes they do. But look at all the special interest groups in the last couple of years. And I'll try not to get political there. But, I mean, we've certainly heard from the collective voices of many groups of special interest people, you know, whether it's LGBT, whether it's Black Lives Matter, whether it's whoever it is. And within every one of those groups is a segment of people with physical or mental disability. Well, yeah. Their group doesn't speak up for them.
Right.
And every yeah. one of those groups has them. So the answer would be that that's the answers, see, seem simple to me on one hand, but obviously they're complex. But it's by us working as a team with loud voices and simply going to the people, you know, that we've got all these elections going on and coming up, and just saying, what is your plan? And if you don't have a plan, they're a one-term person and you kick their ass out. And you keep asking and you keep asking and you ask as a group. And so, you know, I encourage people to write your senators and your congresspeople and say, we've been hearing for, you know, a couple hundred years now that the problem with funding mental health and services for disability, including caregivers, you know, and survivors that need help, is underfunding, understaff, overcrowded, you know, too many people. So what do you plan to do about that? Here's the problem. What do you have to contribute as a solution? Because, you know, we're going all banana republic here, and the corporations and the politicians are making a whole lot of money. Hello. It's our vote that puts you there. So what's your plan? And if they don't have a plan, don't vote for them. Or tell them you'll be sure that they don't have a second term when it comes to your vote. Because truly, as the boomers are getting older, and people, and any of us, as you guys have pointed out, can have a disability any day of the week.
Right.
You know, this is an ongoing issue that's been going on since the beginning of time, but people don't want to deal with it. And so what we need to do is have a loud enough voice. You've had a good primer this last few years with several different special interest groups, some that weren't even legit. Their presidents took the millions of dollars that got donated to them and bought mansions for themselves.
Right.
Or went on a vacation,
right.
You know, so that was complete tripe, you know, but they got a lot of attention, you know, and I'm not suggesting that our group does that. I'm just saying that collective voices mean collective votes to somebody who's running. Do they care about what one person with a mental illness who probably doesn't know the difference, you know, or a person with a disability who can advocate for themselves? Should that be at the top of their priority list? No, they're looking at the corporations, you know, and employers and things like that. Well, you know, there's a lot of things we waste money on, you know, leaving a lot of equipment behind, billions of dollars worth in Afghanistan, for example. That would have gone a long ways in helping our citizens here with the rehab that they need, you know, and the other services that are needed. But because, yes, I think the caregivers should get paid more. It's a huge, very important job, especially if you're the person that needs help and you need to make a living doing it. We want quality caregivers taking those jobs, making it worth their while. And then for everybody to be, you know, responsible and have respect for the other. But, you know, we're not going to get that done unless we raise our voices collectively and make it happen. The same thing, the same cycle will just keep going on the way it has. And I've been writing about it for a while, and you wouldn't believe it. It's sad to think that things haven't changed a lot since,
Kim,
you know,
Kim,
like 1830.
If I can interrupt
yeah,
you.
Yeah, I'm done, Frank. Go ahead.
I want to chime on to something you said. I think Dave and I would have to, Dave, you should think you said, yes, when I say yes, what's happened?
Sure.
We are going into the end times in the Bible now. And that, it's a law. There is a law called the law of entropy. It means that's why Santa snapped his fingers and killed half the people in the world. And I'm just saying that we have reached a time when our spiritual growth has atrophied. And that doesn't mean that, of course, you have to make money, but with making money comes a responsibility. If you're a billionaire, you make so much money, you have to be giving it back. And these people aren't doing that. They're buying yachts and stuff like that. And I think what we have to do is somehow, we have a two-pronged thing. We are producing offspring that aren't aware of what they have to give up,
yes,
of what they have to sacrifice to make it,
yeah.
And they are having their own offspring, which it's going to be, it's going to be entropy.
Word.
If you look up the law of entropy, it says sooner or later everything is going to crash down,
yeah.
And to happen to our world, to happen to our country. In the meantime, we don't know how to fix this. So I'm proposing that you write your book. Now, one thing we should be focusing on is our spirituality, our growth, and whatever you believe is going to happen when we die. If you believe in Christ, that's okay. If you believe in something else, whatever you believe in has to be the main focus. And then you have to be able to move up the pyramid of hierarchy so that you aren't at the bottom fighting over food, fighting over crap that you are so immature about that you don't know what you're talking about. You are a grown parent who's not taking care of his kids, who's out there having sex, having our kids come out and not being responsible. And I think that is something that we have to face. We have to face this. This happens. 50% of all marriages in our country end up in divorce. What happens to the kids? The kids have two mommies, two dads. They might have three mommies and no dad, or something like that. And so we got.
Yeah.
And all this is keeping every year. You know that my son said the greatest thing, the greatest law in the universe, was when they created the exponential. The exponential. And once it doubles, it triples, it goes quadruple, it goes. And tell me what you have is, I can't remember what Einstein's quote is off the top of my head, but you know what I'm referring to. that sooner or later we have to compound so badly that the third of the population is going to become fourth of half the population, and she'll become a sixth of the population. And there's not going to be anybody left to help anybody. Soon the entire world is going to be consumed with it, I think is what I'm trying to say. And so we have to be prepared for this, not only financially, not only morally, but spiritually too, is what I'm trying to say. And we have a big
problem. I agree. And Frank, I'm sorry, I don't want to cut you off, but since we were talking about, it was my fault too. Since tonight we're in overtime and we were talking about caregivers and people who need caregivers, let's leave it at the topic. We can do another show another night and maybe talk about this, because it is, you know, the loss of spirituality and the crumbling of our fiber in this nation right now. You're absolutely right, and I agree with you, but let's not bleed the topic when it's so late. For all of us, it's late, and you guys are even in the East Coast. I'm in the Central Coast, but I've got an early morning doctor appointment. But I want to thank you so much for coming on, Frank. It was a pleasure to have you back. And Dave, thank you so much for coming on tonight. It's been a pleasure talking to you and getting to know you and Hatter and the other people that are on the switchboard. I appreciate you guys staying on. Even though I deviated a little bit, we were talking about the pay earlier, and that's just kind of what it reminded me of, is what I've been working on. But another topic for another night. I hope you guys have a takeaway on caregivers and everybody taking responsibility for their end of it. You know, the survivors, clients need the help. So they need to act in a certain way to be able to keep that help. And the caregivers need a job, and they've got a responsibility toward the people they're taking care of, outlined in their job description. And that means not being on the telephone or being disrespectful or opportunistic toward the people that they're working for. So let's try to clean up that little corner. And hopefully tonight you've gotten some tips from both sides that get you thinking. I know it got me thinking, and I appreciate you both being here tonight. So thank you so much for being my guest. I appreciate it.
Well, thanks.
Thank you, Kim, for having us. I'm sorry that you opened the window and I jumped in as I usually do when a person touches me. If they open the window up, I jump in and I say, heck, I know it's going to fall somebody, but you did take responsibility for allowing me to do that. I'm sorry if I'm offending you and getting upset by saying that.
No, no.
But that,
you
what
didn't.
Happened,
no, you absolutely didn't. I agree with you. I'm just saying it's a separate topic and it's really late. That's all. I agree.
Okay.
I agree completely.
If you want to continue this sometime in the future, I'd be happy to schedule a time with you right now, because Dave, he's enjoying himself. I don't care. I do want Dave to be back, because he is like my best buddy, basically, and we resonate so well. But if he isn't able to be here, anytime you want to have me be on your show again to talk about some of these other things, I'd be happy to do that. And I know you have
a couple of dates
in the future. I don't know when they are. I don't know if they're still open. But if they are open, please let us know if you want to have us back.
I absolutely will. I will have you back. I'm not in my office with my calendar. My office is in the room next to where my husband, who you talked to for a minute yesterday, next to where he goes to bed. I do my show on a different computer on the other side of the house. So I don't have my calculator. actually. It is getting late. Calendar. I don't have my calendar with me right now, but
well,
I will check out my calendar and be back in touch.
You did tell me you had open, Joe. I said, well, I'm so unkind. I'm key to you. Dave says,
I'm not sure that you would want July 5th because I may play music. I don't know if you want to talk about anything serious because July 5th, I don't know about where you guys live, but fireworks are legal, unfortunately, where I live.
Yeah.
And for a week around 4th of July, you know, and I've got dogs and I've been diagnosed with PTSD, it drives me crazy. It doesn't scare me.
Yeah.
It just makes me want to go out and hurt people that are doing it. And it scares my dogs. And they go on. You know, it's the weirdest thing. They give these hours, and they're pretty frickin' liberal hours, from like 9 o'clock in the morning until 11 o'clock at night. And damn, will people start at 8 o'clock in the morning and go till 1 in the morning? Yes. And it goes on for, used to go on for 2 weeks, and I think they cut it down to 10 days. But the 5th is in the slot that you want, so it will sound like we're doing a show from Basra or something like that. So I don't think that you want that, but I don't think that we want to do that, but I will check my other dates. And anyway, I've got to run. I got to get to a doctor, but thank you, Dave. Thank you, Frank. Have a good rest of the week, and we will be in touch. And I'm going to close this out tonight. Thank you. With you were talking about music, Dave, and I know you guys will be free to hang up, but the person who founded our network is also a longtime musician. He's taking a break right now. Something happened also with his situation that I don't have time to bring up right now. But they were on label at one time, and I'm going to close out with a song called Brain Injury Road. And the band this came from was called The THEE, the letter R, Insane, The R Insane. And their music is out and about, but the band is not together any longer. But because we're Brain Injury Radio, I thought it would be apt to close with another one of the original hosts, the actual founder. So this is Craig from The R Insane, and this song is Brain Injury Road. Good night and God bless everyone. Thanks so much.
Benefits that I'm gonna keep on walking down my road. no wonder that the world don't care enough. We got drugs being used, kids so confused. It's too out their whole life, all the scene is abuse. We've got countries fighting countries, people killing people. When are we gonna stop and realize everybody's equal? I don't know. But as far as I can tell, the rich are getting richer while the poor are needing help. So dig right down deep inside of your soul and find the peace, love, and happiness that's shining like gold in your mind. Feel so great, it's all you need to be, it's all you can, the best you can, and I know you can. Just sing with me now. I'm gonna keep on walking down my road. I know.